And welcome to another edition of the Natural Nurse and Dr. Z, everybody. Happy New Year out there. And this is Dr. Z. Dr. Kamai has the Natural Nurse has the day off. And we're excited to bring you another program on health, wellness, and issues in alternative medicine today. And a little later on, we'll be bringing on our guest, and he is the co-author of The Great Cholesterol Myth, Why Lowering Your Cholesterol Won't Prevent Heart Disease, and The Statin-Free Plan That Will. And this is, you know, this is something I've been talking about as a naturopathic doctor and the natural nurse for the last 20 years. We've been talking about that, you know, the idea that cholesterol is like the fireman showing up for a fire. It's like a response to inflammatory and what we call inflammaging on the show, degenerative changes going on in the body. And to take it out is like killing the fireman for showing up to the fire. The true way to heal atherosclerosis and create, you know, again, the statin-free plan, as our guest will talk about in a second there, is really to do stuff that's well elucidated in this fabulous book. So our guest is Johnny Bowden, and I hope I said your name right, Johnny.
Perfectly, thank you.
Okay.
You also summed the book up better than I've ever heard it summed up. That was great.
Yeah, great. Well, you know, we'll get into the nitty-gritty because it's very interesting, and I got some really great questions for you. But let me just give you a breakdown about yourself there, that you have a Ph.D. and a certified nutritionist. And you've certainly published quite a number of books there, 150 Healthiest Foods on Earth, which we'd like to have you back at some point and talk about that book.
Sure.
Living Low Carb, and then this, of course, The Great Cholesterol Myth, and you've been TV and on radio, on major networks and things like that, and have quite a bit of expertise and quite a bit of advisory boards for many magazines, Men's Health, Pilates. You're in great shape. I've seen pictures of you. I like to see the people and see if they walk the walk and talk the talk. No one's perfect, but nonetheless, it certainly is good for that. And so we want to talk a little bit about this book. So let's set a context for this very interesting book there. We've been kind of led down this path of misinformation for many, many years, and have created like a paradigm. You start the book with the foreword, like, you know, where doctors years ago bled, purged, and, you know, blistered the patients, and bloodletting was standard, and everyone bought into it. It went back to even Galen's time, and certainly Hippocrates even started with the four humors. But then, you know, and not to say that removing blood isn't a good thing sometimes, actually. So there's a little bit of, there's a grain of truth in even in these ancient therapies. But the whole idea is, I call it like flat earth medicine. Everybody buys into a paradigm except for the alternative people, like you and I and other people, Dr. Mel. And then all of a sudden, we're considered crackpots when we're talking things that should be basic biochemistry lessons for physicians. Tell us a little bit about how we got into this quagmire, realize, and does cholesterol cause heart disease?
Well, I could not have said that better or summed that up better. You know, as I said on the Dr. Oz show, trying to lower heart disease by lowering cholesterol is like trying to lower the calories on your plate by taking the lettuce off your double burger. Yeah, there's a calorie or two in lettuce, but is that really the target you want to go for when you've got a supersized French fries and a huge chocolate shake in front of you? Is that really what you want to go for? Cholesterol is a minor player in heart disease, and the story of how it came to be conceived of, as you put it, in the paradigm came about that cholesterol is a causative factor in heart disease is a very interesting story. And we go through the history of that. It's a recent history, the last 30 years. We go through that in the book, and it's a very interesting story filled with political intrigue that makes this last Congress just look like child's play. If you want, we can get into how we all kind of became under the spell of this myth. It is interesting, but what we're left with is that we are under the spell of this myth. This is the current paradigm, although it's beginning to change. You're starting to see some cracks in the wall. Most physicians in America still believe that lowering cholesterol is a noble and important goal, and that it is really going to protect lives and really save lives and really reduce heart disease. They are mistaken. We show why in vivid detail in the book. So pick your poison. Where do you want to start? How we got bamboozled into thinking this? Why we still believe it? What are some of the casualties of believing it? Because I as we point out in the book, this is not just some innocuous hypothesis. By focusing obsessively on this incredibly important molecule that we all need to live, by focusing obsessively on lowering cholesterol, we've taken our eye off the ball of what really causes heart disease. So we're not paying attention to the things we really need to pay attention to that we can do something about, like inflammation, oxidative damage, stress, sugar in the diet. These are the real causative factors in heart disease, and we're ignoring them because we're all focused. You know, the example I gave, it's a very politically incorrect example, but the example I gave on one talk show was this. It's like we were attacked on 9/11, and we all got together and decided, let's go after Portugal because there's a terrorist in there somewhere. So let's put all of our national resources into attacking Portugal. Well, it's just idiotic. Cholesterol shouldn't be the target of lowering heart disease. And as you can see, and as we show in the study, when you look beneath the hood of the studies, lowering cholesterol doesn't do very much for preventing heart attacks, not only on the individual level, but on the population level as well.
Well, it's like one of our naturopathic aphorisms. We treat people, not laboratory results.
Oh, I love that. I actually said that on the Dr. Oz show. I said, when doctors are treating this, you're treating numbers, not patients. Which it sounds to me is very similar to what you just said. We're treating numbers, not patients.
And also a good one is healthcare reform is self-care reform. And so because people are responsible for the choices they make, and we want to go over because you outline the proper choices to make. And we know everyone's a little biologically different. Some people thrive on more fatty acids than others. People have genetic problems taking one fatty acid and making it into good forms and things like the old Celtic curse. But you know, you say here in page 17, you lay it out straight. What do you got to know? Cholesterol is a minor player in heart disease. Cholesterol levels are poor predictors of heart attacks. Half the people with heart disease have normal cholesterol. Half the people with elevated cholesterol have healthy hearts. Right. Lowering cholesterol has extremely limited benefits. And one thing I would add is that cholesterol, and I think you talk about it in the forward, is that cholesterol is very important for things like making bile for proper digestion.
Yes.
Vitamin D synthesis. And even making all your hormones. Johnny, you can't make any hormones without cholesterol. So when their testosterone falls as they get older, 40s and 50s, of course the body's going to make more cholesterol. It's going to make it as a response to that problem. Are you there? Okay, looks like we have some, somehow we dropped the call. So maybe we can go to a couple of public service announcements and return and try to get our guest back. And I think we're back with Johnny. Johnny, are you there?
I am. I heard every word you said.
Wow, I guess we got so excited that we just kind of just shorted ourselves out there.
I know, we just burned up the waves.
Well, tell us a little bit about kind of like what we talked about, some of those facts that you have on page 17 there.
Yeah, and you know, you were talking so eloquently about the need for cholesterol in the body and what it does, and I'd like to get one thing off my chest about this immediately, because if there's really any take-home message, You know, people listen to these interviews, they remember a couple of bullet points, maybe. Mm-hmm. So I want to make one that we can possibly come back to as well.
Yeah.
There is a huge market, a huge marketing effort going on right now, subtly, that maybe people are just beginning to get aware of, and it is to put children on statin drugs. And you're hearing this in press releases and news reports, planted news reports about, you know, our kids are getting heart disease earlier, their cholesterol is so high, we should start to put children on statin drugs. So let me just give parents who are listening to this a couple of facts. Your child's brain is not fully grown, physically grown. It hasn't stopped growing until he's 25. The cholesterol is needed for memory, for the making of sex hormones, for thinking, for emotion, for fighting infections. The idea of artificially lowering this potent molecule in a child's brain who has not finished growing yet is the next thalidomide waiting to happen. Parents, if you've got a doctor who is telling you to put your kid on a statin drug, I beg you, change doctors. It is medical malpractice. That's a point I'd like to make. I don't know if you agree with that.
No, I totally
feel very strongly.
I've said it many times on the program.
Wonderful.
And certainly, totally agree with it.
Yeah. So, you know, going back to the function, it's very interesting, which, you know, just I know this is not necessarily the order you wanted to talk about this stuff with, but speaking of statin drugs, we don't take the position that statin drugs are the spawn of Satan and should never be prescribed under any circumstances to anyone. We don't say that. There are people on the left wing of this issue who actually do feel that way, but we're a little more moderate in that. What we do say is that statin drugs have tremendous side effects, and those side effects are tremendously underreported. How do we know this? Because there is a magnificent peer-reviewed study by Beatrice Golomb out of Stanford University that polled physicians and found that 65% of them did not report to the federal reporting agencies, MedWatch, did not report the side effects of statin drugs because they didn't believe their patients that these effects were a result of the drug. In other words, people would come in and go, "Doc, I'm forgetting my teeth. I keep having these memory lapses." Up, oh, you're getting older. "Doc, I've got all these pains in my joints and my muscles, and, you know, it's muscle pain ever since I started taking Lipitor." "Nah, you're just getting older. It's just arthritis." They don't believe it. They have been so successfully marketed to by the pharmaceutical companies that they literally do not believe that these side effects are coming from the statin drug, so they don't report them. So we know that this is a drug with powerful potential side effects: loss of memory, transient globular amnesia, loss of sex drive. As you mentioned earlier, you make your sex hormones from cholesterol. You think it's a coincidence that when these drugs have become so ridiculously popular that there's also an epidemic of erectile dysfunction? I don't think that's a coincidence. So you've got this important molecule that we are lowering in search of a blood test and not in search of fixing heart disease, which is what we really care of. What
well, you know, they
we're
argue,
doing is
they
creating
argue,
a number.
Johnny, that, you know, we're not turning it totally off, because I've had this debate with physicians on panels and other bastions of allopathic, thinking.
Sure.
And they say, well, we don't turn it totally off.
What, turn cholesterol?
Drugs don't turn it totally off.
Well, thank God they don't turn it totally off. But what they do is they interrupt, for those who are interested in this kind of gobbledygook, statin drugs are in a class of medications called HMG reductase inhibitors, which means they turn off the enzyme that makes cholesterol in the body. But they do something else as well. They actually cut off a pathway that produces a number of other things that your body needs desperately, such as coenzyme Q10. So when you take a statin drug, you're stopping the machinery that makes cholesterol, but that same machinery, that same factory, also makes a few other things. And when you lower those things, you're in deep trouble. So the irony of taking a drug for heart disease that cuts off production of coenzyme Q10, which is one of the most important nutrients the heart needs, the irony of this is just Alice in Wonderland mind-boggling.
Yeah,
and
because
the
down the road, you're gonna get,
tell
you may
their
get cardiac, they, you may get cardiomyopathy from
the
actual treatment
Q10.
Of quote-unquote heart disease. So, yeah, I understand.
You know, and the fact that doctors, you know, I play tennis. I'm a tennis player. I play every single day out here in Southern California. I play with a lot of old guys, you know, old guys and young guys. I've got a lot of old guys that I play with. And, you know, a lot of them are winded. A lot of them are this and that. And they say, well, you're on a statin. They're on statin drugs. They never had a heart attack, but their doctor's treating the number. I said, are you taking CoQ10? No.
Yeah.
Did your doctor not tell you that this drug is depleting CoQ10? No.
Now, don't
I'll
you
ask
them
about it. And
don't
then
you
they
think
come
that
back.
Would be like a big class action lawsuit that none of these doctors are telling people to take CoQ10?
Yeah. If you lawyers, if you're listening, jump on this one.
Yeah, I think it's a huge. I've seen some of the ambulance chaser lawyers go after
Where are
other,
they when
other
we need
things.
Them, right?
Where are they on the statins?
Yeah. Yeah. No kidding. But this is a serious issue because coenzyme Q10, which is a...
Okay, looks like, unfortunately, we lost our guest again. Maybe he's on a cell phone or something like that. So, anyway, we'll go back to some music, and we'll continue our wonderful discussion with Johnny Bowden. Right back to it. So, hey, Johnny. Okay, great. So we were talking about, being frustrated that, the medical establishment basically has, hoodwinked people. And we wanted to get into more about, and of course, how statin drugs have quite a number of side effects. But we want to really talk a lot about... what happened in medicine that these things became so popular? What's the politics about it?
Oh, it's very interesting. This kind of became national policy in 1984 when they had a group called the Consensus Committee. And the Consensus Committee, and there's a whole interesting story about how they even formed this Consensus Committee and why this was a controversy in the first place. But the Consensus Committee came out with a statement and basically agreed with the prevailing theory about cholesterol and heart disease. But what's interesting is when we investigated it, that Consensus Committee had about as much consensus as the U.S. Congress just had with this deal on the fiscal cliff. It was contentious. There were people who walked out, people who did not agree with what the Consensus Committee position was, but somehow they bamboozled the theory that cholesterol and saturated fat, it's called the lipid hypothesis, that these things were, in fact, at the root cause of heart disease. Now, what a lot of people don't know is there were two competing theories at the time. One of them, which was advocated by Ansel Keys, was that, the lipid hypothesis, the cholesterol in the blood is a causative factor, and that, saturated fat raises cholesterol, therefore that's the demon. That whole group of theories, that was one of them. But there was a competing theory. Those people who may be old enough to remember the format wars with VHS and Betamax may remember how, you have two different camps. And the one that has the better ground game wins. VHS won that war, but it was the inferior technology. Betamax was a much better system. Well, the inferior technology won this conceptual war. The high-fat people won the war, but the other theory was that sugar tracked with heart disease better than fat did, that sugar was inflammatory, that sugar correlated with heart disease in a much stronger and more powerful fashion than fat ever did. Mm. The wrong theory won. It was just like that contentious Congress that we just all witnessed with the fiscal cliff, and you had these battling scientists, and somehow the guys who thought it was fat got their foothold, had a better ground game, had more influence, and became the accepted theory. Now, I don't believe that this is a big medical hoax, a big medical conspiracy, that everybody got together Dick Cheney-like in some fortress or bunker underneath the White House, and they said, let's see how we can put this hoax over on the American people. I don't think that at all. Doctors are well-meaning people. They have very little time to spend with patients. They've got about 4 to 7 minutes in an HMO. They're marketed to relentlessly by the pharmaceutical companies, and interestingly enough, study after study has shown that they are the
It is like taking candy from a baby to market it to doctors because they don't think they're being marketed to. And every one of them thinks that they're impervious to any kind of, you know, perky little pharmaceutical rep and samples and honorariums and golf courses. They don't think that that influences them at all. And study after study after study has shown that it does.
Yeah.
So they are marketed to relentlessly. And they honestly believe this stuff, and they think they're doing good. They're not bad people. They're just misled. It's the, as you said, it's the flat earth theory of medicine. It's something that everybody sort of got on board with, like 8 glasses of water a day, or, you know, saturated fat is horrible, or green, whole grains are wonderful, and sort of became this kind of cultural meme, and it's just not so.
And now we're kind of, you know, in chapter two of your book, we look at that even the old blood test, when we do the lipid panel, that
yes.
If we put on a different pair of spectacles, we see the lipid panel in the new light versus the old light, or the new school versus the old school.
Yeah,
so,
well, that is a very important point.
Tell us
yes.
a little bit about, you know, how
sure.
we looked at, so what's the old school of cholesterol
it.
Was that it was bad. Now we're saying it's a basic material that your body uses to make the sex hormones, all kinds of wonderful anti-inflammatory things, bile and stuff. But what about the other markers like HDL and LDL and triglycerides?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Can you review that for us, Johnny?
I would love to. Yeah. See, here's the story, folks. If you're old enough to remember this, I'm dating myself. Back in before the 60s, you went to a health fair. You'd have a little blood prick done, and they'd say, oh, Mr. Jones, your cholesterol, 240, 190, 210. Cholesterol was one number. It was this substance that traveled around the bloodstream. We didn't even know that much about it, but we were able to measure it in the bloodstream. Okay, around 1961, technology got a little bit better, and we noticed, cholesterol actually travels throughout the body in two different kinds of packages. One is called an HDL, high-density lipoprotein. The other one is called an LDL. And they seem to function a little differently. You know what? It's all cholesterol is not the same. There's HDL and LDL, and they became known as good cholesterol and bad cholesterol. And that's how we've been measuring it ever since. And if you told people to go back to measuring total cholesterol, they'd say, that's antiquated. That's out of date. Well, the good cholesterol, bad cholesterol test is also out of date. We have known for over a decade, possibly two, that there are 5 different kinds of HDL, 5 different kinds of LDL so far that we've discovered, and 2 of those types of LDL, let's call them LDL-A and LDL-B, behave very differently in the body. LDL-A, if you look at it under a microscope, looks like a cotton ball. It's big and fluffy, and it does just as much damage to the artery walls as if you threw a cotton ball at it. LDL-B, on the other hand, is a nasty little bugger. That is an inflammatory little thing that looks like a BB gun. It does get lodged into the artery walls. But the point is, if you're doing your old-fashioned cholesterol test with just HDL and LDL, you're treating a number because all LDL isn't the same. You want your LDL fluffy molecule, LDL-A, to be as high as possible. And you want your LDL, well, not as high as possible, but you want that high, and you want your LDL-B to be low. And if you just look at total LDL, you're missing the boat. So things like saturated fat, which we've been told to avoid so much, actually raises LDL-A, the big fluffy kind, and reduces the inflammatory LDL-B while raising HDL. So although your number goes up, your lipid profile improves. And this is something that is wholly missed by many, many doctors. That test is called the particle test. And anybody who's listening to this, just Google LDL particle test. There are at least 4 of them. They are often covered by insurance. They are common. They can be gotten anywhere. And that's the test that means something.
Actually,
without,
you know, some of the insurance companies, unfortunately, have been denying them recently, I think.
Dumb.
Maybe they're getting wise to it. Yeah, some of my patients were hemming
yeah.
and hawing. But anyway, I thought it was very important for them to get that.
You know, here's an interesting thing. You'll love this. I was debating this subject with a conventional cardiologist. Great guy, but, you know, in mainstream cardiologist on another radio show. And I told this story about the particle test and about, you know, treating numbers with the other one. And he said to me, well, of course, you're absolutely right. That is the only test that matters. But insurance doesn't cover it.
Yeah.
And I said, well, so are you going to continue to give a test that gives useless information because it's paid for, or do you want to give people a test that actually gives something that they can do something with that actually
right.
matters?
Exactly. So then later on in the book, you talk about what I kind of opened up the program with, the whole story of inflammation, or what I call inflammaging.
I love that term.
Is the true cause of heart disease.
It's actually at the heart of, to use a pun, at the heart of almost every degenerative disease we know of. Alzheimer's patients who do autopsies, their brains are filled with inflammation. A cancer, obesity, diabetes, all of these things have huge inflammatory components. So inflammation is probably the best target for us if we want to prevent not only heart disease, but a lot of the diseases of aging.
So now why are people inflamed? Like why this sudden, or maybe it's not sudden, increase in inflammation?
Well, you know, to live is to have inflammation. The air we breathe has pollutants. The medicines we take have to be detoxified. Stress is inflammatory. Things that raise blood pressure are inflammatory. Things in the foods. There's just a million things that cause us to increase inflammation in the body. The oils that we eat are a huge source of inflammation. Here's one of the great ironies of all time. As I'm sure your very bright audience knows, there are two essential fatty acids, omega-6s and omega-3s. Omega-6s are found in vegetable oils like corn oil and safflower oil and sunflower oil and soybean oil and all of these. And omega-3s, of course, are found in fish and grass-fed beef. Now, the omega-6s, the vegetable oils we've all been told are so wonderfully healthy, we should switch from saturated fat to canola oil, all of that stuff. The omega-6s are the building blocks. They are the molecules out of which our body builds inflammatory compounds. Now, you might say, well, what do we need inflammatory compounds for? Well, you know better than anyone, inflammation is part of the healing process. If you stub your toe or get a splinter, it swells up because there's white blood cells and fluid going to the area, and the white blood cells surround it. They try to prevent an infection from a microbe. And so this inflammation is actually part of the healing process. But you also have to fund your anti-inflammatory army, and that comes from omega-3s. Omega-3s are the building blocks of the anti-inflammatory compounds that your body makes. Those two fatty acids, the 6s and the 3s, need to be in balance. Our current diet is between 16 to 25 times more high in omega-6s. It's a 16-to-1 ratio all the way up to a 20-to-1 ratio, or 25-to-1 ratio in some places. That's not a one-to-one ratio. So we are overfunding our inflammatory army to the tune of about 1,600% more funds going to our inflammation army than our anti-inflammation army.
Yeah.
So I believe that the fat that we really should be cutting back on are vegetable oils, because those are the ones that are inflammatory. Now, I'm not saying not to eat them. I'm not saying they're bad. They're essential. But they need to be in balance with our omega-3s.
Right.
So I think the focus on fat has gone to the wrong direction. Saturated fat's pretty neutral. Your body makes it. It's needed for many different functions. But a high level of omega-6s, like we have in the American diet, is unprecedented in human existence.
Well, you know, and then you also talk a little bit about how that inflammation translates to damage to the arteries, and how cholesterol acts like almost like a spackle.
Patchwork, yeah.
Like when you plaster, like when the wall cracks, you call up the painter, and he, or she, can't be sexist, spackles the ceiling or spackles the wall, tapes it up.
Yeah. Well, here's the best way to conceive of this. I live near, in Southern California. You go to the ocean, you see those big, huge boulders of rocks, and they have these little pit marks in them. And that comes from the pounding of the water against the rocks for centuries, right? You see those little pit marks? Well, our arteries have those little pit marks, and those are inflammatory little injuries in the artery wall. And when we have those little inflammation, and they can come from high blood pressure, they can come from any of the things I mentioned earlier, any of the things that cause inflammation, oxidative damage, too much sugar in the diet, all these things contribute to these little tiny kind of pit marks, which then get patched up and then attract those little nasty LDL B particles, just the B particles are the only ones we need to worry about, and they get entrapped in there, and then there's more oxidative damage, and it starts a whole cascade that can lead to plaque. But without inflammation, none of this happens.
Right.
Now, we can't get rid of inflammation completely, but that should be our target. Inflammation, oxidative damage, which is, as we all know, put out by antioxidants. Sugar contributes to this in a myriad of different ways. It raises insulin, which also contributes to the whole cascade leading to heart disease. So we're really focusing on the wrong target here.
And you talk about that sugar causes ages. We have a T-shirt. It's so funny at where I teach at the University of Bridgeport Naturopathic College. It says it's the ages that age you, and these ages are the advanced glycosylated end products. Talk about that for a sec.
Sure, and that's a very clever T-shirt that probably a joke that very few people get.
No, well, we know it amongst ourselves, so it's kind of fun.
Very good. Well, what basically happens is this. When you have too much sugar in the bloodstream, it begins to glom on to proteins, and it makes them sticky. Now, proteins are like tadpoles. They're slithery and slippery. You shouldn't be able to grab them, and they're able to get in and out of all kinds of very thin little areas. Hmm. That's what proteins are supposed to look like. If you've got too much sugar in the bloodstream, it's like putting sugar in your gas tank. It starts to knock into these proteins, and the proteins become what's called glycolated. They become glycosylated. They become sticky with sugar. They become like cotton candy. Then they can't slither in and out of things too well. This is why diabetics have trouble with their eyes, their big toes, and their kidneys, because those tiny little capillaries are fine for proteins in the blood to get through, but not so fine when the proteins are contaminated with sugar. Now, what happens is these glycolated proteins, these sugar-infested proteins, if you will, these sticky proteins, they start to lump together. It's like losers attract losers. So now you've got a whole little cluster of losers, and we call these advanced glycolated end products. These are little clusters of these proteins, and this is what we measure when we look for diabetes. You look for hemoglobin A1C, which is glycolated hemoglobin. It's these sticky sugar protein complexes, and they're not good.
So instead of the cholesterol insanity or cholesterol mania, we need to be on the, back on the high fructose corn syrup mania to try to really stop that from. Exactly. And, it's funny, you watch commercials where the corn industry has come back and said, oh, this is good stuff. It's just as bad as, it's just as good as sugar and blah, blah, blah. Well, sugar's not even that great to begin with, right?
Yeah, here's the interesting thing about that. And God knows, I can't even, you talk about politics make strange bedfellows. I never thought I'd be on the same side of any issue as the Corn Refiners Association of America, which puts out those commercials about how wonderful high fructose corn syrup is. But here's the fact. They're kind of right. It's no worse than sugar. But that's like saying, Montezuma's Revenge is no worse than diarrhea. I mean, they're both horrible. It's the fructose molecule in sugar that is the most metabolically damaging. And to my way of thinking, whether it's 50% sugar, 50% fructose, which it is in table sugar, or 55%, which it is in high fructose corn syrup, it's not a big difference. It's not a big distinction. They are both horrible. So that is such a disingenuous campaign to say, hey, we're just as good as sugar. Yeah, you are. That's like saying the Crips are just as good as the blood. Those are
just as poison. What's more poison is lead or mercury? It's like saying, oh, okay.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, that's like the mercury industry saying, hey, we're as good as lead. Okay, great, guys. I don't want to eat either one of you. Thank you very much.
Now, don't statin drugs bring down some inflammation? I know that there's been some arguments saying, oh, well, the statins, reduce inflammation, and maybe that's why they're working, and reduce NF-kappa-beta, which is this fancy, for listeners out there, this pro-inflammatory intracellular messenger called a kinase that kind of moves around and helps orchestrate inflammation.
Yeah.
So I've heard that argument from MDs.
That argument is actually correct. My cardiologist co-writer, Steve Sinatra, has said many times, statins have some benefits. It's a very modest benefit, and it's in a very narrow population, but they do have some benefits, and here's one of them. They're mildly anti-inflammatory, and I happen to think that we're so darn inflamed that people are eating such crummy diets and doing so many wrong lifestyle choices that for some of these people, you give them a statin drug, even that paltry little bit of anti-inflammation is going to help them out. So, yes, it's mildly anti-inflammatory. It also mildly thins the blood. So, yes, statin drugs do a couple of good things. Now, here's the question. Can you reduce inflammation better, more effectively, with a natural substance like fish oil with no side effects? And the answer is yes. So, yeah, sure, they are mildly anti-inflammatory, but why not go for the real thing, which is fish oil, which blows statins out of the water when it comes to anti-inflammatory action, and they don't have side effects.
Now, on page 130, Dr. Sinatra has a really incredible list of things that are very critical for the listeners to take home from our discussion as far as which nutrients seem to be extremely critical for helping out with inflammation and heart disease. Mm-hmm. He lists things like, and I'd like you to comment on these things, Johnny, CoQ10, ribose, big believer in ribose, carnitine, mm-hmm. magnesium. We talked about omega-3s pretty well. And
yeah.
also other types of things like the clot busters, because it turns out that the hemodynamics of the blood, like you talked about sugar thickening the blood, that's one mechanism of changing hemodynamics, and now
right.
that's the latest rage amongst, I know my profession is to try to figure out the hemodynamics of the blood, but mm-hmm. and this is beyond just platelet aggregation. There's other factors that change the way that the blood flows, and that also might play a huge role in preventing heart disease.
Well, of course, you want your blood, as Steve says, you don't want it to look like ketchup. You don't want it thick. You don't want those platelets to, you know, platelet aggregation is a technical term, but basically means that red blood cells are clumping together. You don't want this. You don't want it looking like ketchup. You want it kind of flowing like Kool-Aid. So you want the blood to be a little bit on the thinner side. And certainly these nutrients that Steve talks about now, he calls those, the four that you mentioned, coenzyme Q10, carnitine, ribose, which is a wonderful sugar that actually the body makes that we use for energy and that always needs to be replenished, especially for athletes or people who have in any way weakened hearts. It's a very important nutrient. And magnesium, which relaxes the blood vessels. He calls those four the awesome force of metabolic cardiology. I think they're all important. He's had a lot of luck using that particular formulation of four nutrients with his heart patients.
Right.
I don't, myself, for preventive and for people who are in, you know, great health and just looking to, you know, get some insurance, I don't put carnitine and ribose on my must-have list because I find they're wonderful therapeutic agents, but not necessarily if people are trying to cut down on the number of supplements they're taking. I don't put those on my, like, top 10 list, but they're very important for recovery from any kind of heart disease or if there's any kind of weakening or any kind of loss of energy or function. I think
interesting. I do a lot of, you know, checking for heavy metals like many holistic physician.
Right.
And so when I find that the patient is very high in cadmium and lead, which yeah. I know are pro-oxidant, particularly for the
sure.
arteries and whatnot, I want to emphasize carnitine because, see, carnitine is made from methionine and lysine, and we know
right.
methionine is one of the great detoxifiers.
Yep.
Methionine somewhat goes over as in a form of maybe SAMe to keep mm-hmm. homocysteine down. And
mm-hmm.
so, and if you're robbing from Peter to pay Paul, if you're using all your SAMe and methionine to detoxify because
right.
you got all this arsenic and lead and mercury and
sure, sure.
cadmium in your body, plus the
right.
bad fats and stuff, then you may have a dearth of carnitine.
Yes, I couldn't agree more. But I talk to lots of people, you know, who are not really, they haven't had heart disease. They want to prevent it.
Right.
They're doing all the right things. Their doctors are putting them on statins because their cholesterol is 210, some ridiculous thing like that, which I've actually seen.
Wow.
When they ask what supplements should I be taking, what's a good preventive, you know, preventive maintenance
right.
for someone who's healthy? Coenzyme Q10, everybody needs. It's just, you know, we make less of it as we get older. It's important for the heart. It's an absolute necessity if you're on a statin drug, but I think I take coenzyme Q10 every day. Omega-3s we talked about. Number one supplement with a bullet. Magnesium, which nobody gets enough of. Every survey shows between 75 and 80% of the population doesn't even get the RDA for magnesium, let alone like a really decent dosage. And it relaxes blood vessels. It relaxes the brain. It's just a very, you know, milk of magnesium. What is that when you soak in Epsom salts? It's all very relaxing. It's all magnesium. So we need magnesium. The others I like very much are curcumin and resveratrol. both of which have multiple actions across the body. Curcumin particularly is just, it's anti-inflammatory, it's very good for the liver, it's a tremendous antioxidant, it's just a great, great supplement, curcumin. I like the BCM 95 form of curcumin because it's better absorbed than the others. Resveratrol, the trans-resveratrol portion of resveratrol, which a lot of companies don't specify that on their resveratrol, but you should look for that. That's the active ingredient. Resveratrol has multiple positive functions in the body. And then vitamin C, because oxidative damage in the artery wall is a big factor as well. You know, we have this inflammation, and then it's sort of a chicken and an egg thing, because the more oxidative damage, the more inflammation, the more inflammation, the more oxidative damage. So you really need to handle the antioxidant aspect of this as well, and vitamin C does that, and then vitamin D, because nobody gets enough of it. So I think that that's kind of my core program. And then if there's any issue like you talked about with heavy metals or with previous heart disease or with fatigue or lack of energy, then you throw in that metabolic cardiology awesome portion of carnitine and ribose along with the CoQ10 and magnesium. And that's a program that really will strengthen the heart. And, of course, it's not just about supplements. We talk in the book, The Great Cholesterol Myth, about one of the neglected promoters of heart disease, which is stress. You can die from stress. This is not just all in your head. There is a huge physiological, biochemical reaction when you're stressed. And that reaction, those hormones, cortisol, adrenaline, can cause enormous damage to the artery walls. There's real physiological reasons. There are people who have died. I'll give you a great example. Out here in California, we had an enormous earthquake in the late 80s called the Northridge Quake. When they went back and looked at records of that particular Monday in history, 5 times more people died in the quake than any other Monday in history at that same time, except none of them died in the quake. They all died from heart attacks. So stress can actually bring on a heart attack, even in people with very clean arteries. So we must address stress as a lifestyle issue. And that means getting rid of toxic relationships. It means getting out and getting some air. It means getting some sunshine. It means interacting with people you love. It means petting animals, making love. I mean, all of these things are stress relievers, and you cannot neglect that in a heart disease prevention program.
It's interesting that you look at stress, because that's something that I think, physicians have kind of agreed upon. I don't know if they teach their patients enough stress management in the 10-minute office call.
Heidi, what do you think? Let's take a guess. I'm not sure they even know. I'm not sure that doctors fully appreciate it. Look, you know why? There's no drugs for stress. So the psychiatric profession's got a million things for anxiety and depression and all that, but the kind of stress we're talking about, everyday stress that every one of us is under, we don't have medicines for that. Those are lifestyle interventions.
There's the medicines are like, you know, taking and practicing yoga and meditation. I schedule a ghost patient once in a while just so I can, do something else, or just kind of this hydrotherapy and, naturopathic medicine. We're big believers in hydrotherapy. Even the simple foot bath is a great stress reducer.
And
anyone can do a foot bath. It's just you put some Epsom salts in nice warm water, and as you're watching the tube or listening to some music, sit on a chair and do a
great
foot
idea.
Bath. It's not rocket science, Johnny, far as stress management goes. What about drinking coffee and people's other habits?
Well, I'm a contrarian on the coffee issue. I don't think it's the great health risk of the 21st century.
But doesn't coffee increase your adrenaline and output all those stress hormones, the catecholamines and things?
A little bit. There's a couple things to say about that. My dear friend Mark Houston, who's head of the Hypertension Institute in St. Joseph's Hospital in Tennessee, and one of my go-to guys for hypertension, pointed out to me that the recent research shows that there are actually some genes that predispose us to be what we might call coffee responders. And I think we're going to keep finding this in a lot of things, aspartame, a lot of these things. So much like with salt, not everybody responds badly to coffee. The second thing about it is that coffee is an enormous source of antioxidants. The third thing, it shares many of the flavanols with cocoa, actually. The third thing about it is that there's a lot of literature showing that coffee drinkers have lower risks of a number of different diseases, from gout to Parkinson's to diabetes. So coffee is not all bad. Blood pressure tends to normalize after an hour when you have coffee. It's like running up a flight of stairs. It comes back to normal. I am not telling everybody in the world to go out and drink all the coffee that they possibly can get down from a Starbucks. But I don't think it's quite, I don't think it's the major target for going after, you know, we probably are a little more caffeinated than we need to be, and probably this, if it's interfering with sleep, you should probably cut it out after 4 in the afternoon. But it's not, I don't consider that the major target to go after here. And I realize that that is a minority opinion among a lot of naturopaths and holistic practitioners. They all think coffee is the worst thing. I'm not so sure.
Okay. So, you know, what types of blood work? We have a few more minutes in the program here, and then wrap it up. But what types of blood work should people, unfortunately, they often have to request it from their physicians.
Yeah.
It's like the patient has to go in and re-educate their doctor. Now, some doctors don't take kind to that, and some of them are open-minded and say, okay, well, you know I learned some of the greatest things from my patients, but I'm an open-minded type of guy. And don't,
you are, and...
And so, but what types of very important benchmark tests besides the old lipid panel, I call it the Leave It to Beaver test from back in the 50s, you know?
Well,
what should people be asking for?
Well, I think number one, seriously with a bullet, is the new, modern, useful cholesterol panel, which is the particle test. I think the more people demand this, I mean, eventually insurance will cover it if they don't cover it already. And by the way, it's not that expensive. I had it done. It wasn't covered by insurance. It's under $100, but it gives you actual information that tells you that it's useful, not this moronic
HDL-LDL stuff. Now, if people have the LDL that's kind of fluffy, then they really don't have to worry about that as much? Is that what you're basically saying? Or it's not as bad as the other one, or what?
That's exactly right.
Okay.
It is not atherogenic, the LDL-A particle. If they're pattern, they call it pattern A or pattern B. If most of the molecules are pattern A, are the big fluffy ones, and there's not tons and tons of particles, it doesn't really matter what the number is. The second thing is there's a test that you can do at home. You don't even have to go to your doctor for. Mm-hmm. And I find this to be one of the best low-tech predictors of a lot of different things, insulin resistance, heart attacks, everything. Look at your blood test, your ordinary regular blood test. Take look at two numbers. The first is triglycerides. The second is HDL. Now, you can do a little fourth-grade math. It's not that hard. We're going to figure out the ratio of triglycerides to HDL. So, for example, if your triglycerides are 100 and your HDL is 50, your ratio is 100 to 50, which is a ratio of 2. Mm-hmm. If your triglycerides are 300 and your HDL is 30, your ratio is 10. Okay. If your ratio is 2, you ain't getting a heart attack. And that's why you can take that as a personal guarantee. It is 16 times more accurate as a predictor of heart disease than any other system that's ever been tested. It predicts what type of LDL you have. If you have a high ratio, over 3 or 4 or 5 or 10, something like that, most of your LDL is probably the small inflammatory kind. You're probably insulin resistant. This is one of the best markers for your health that I know of. The triglyceride to HDL ratio. Do you agree with that, by the way?
Yeah, absolutely. Because, you know, I found that triglycerides tend to go up when people have, you know, some type of either metabolic syndrome, or they're just not processing the carbohydrates really well. And, you know, I go back to, you know, Ayurvedic medicine, where we treat people and not diseases, and we look at the constitution of the patient. And some patients will do well on carbs, and a lot of patients, if they have some, you know, kapha energy, they're too, you know, they tend to be earthy people. Those are people that really need to stay away from the carbohydrates, because they're probably hunter-gatherer type people. And, you know, they really weren't agricultural. So it kind of gets into, I get into the, you know, the ancient history of people and how they evolved. And this is the reason why not everyone's the same, and we do have to alter the diet based on some other people. I know I have some Celtic blood in me, and I don't absorb. When I take flaxseed oil, it doesn't change my flip it panel one bit because I have that delta 6, delta 5 desaturase issue, which means that it's hard. If you eat flax seeds, you can't make it into the EPA and DHA, or it's very difficult. So I have to take extra magnesium and B vitamins, and then I knew I do need to take the fish oil, like you mentioned, Johnny, versus a lot of vegans would say, well, you know, I don't want to do the fish. I'd rather do the flax, you know?
Yeah, well, that becomes more of a political discussion or a values discussion than it does a science discussion, because the fact is that EPA and DHA are the most studied and the most important, and, and you know, I understand people having issues with eating animals, but those are not issues about health. Our bodies do better on some animal products. Now, no one's more of an animal rights person than I am. I totally sympathize, but science is what the science is. We need EPA and DHA. We don't make it very efficiently from flaxseed. If you are a vegan and you won't take fish oil, at least take more flaxseed than you think you should be taking. You need about a tablespoon for every 100 pounds of body weight in order to get some conversion to the EPA-DHA.
Right, but, and extra Bs and extra magnesium, which kind of does a lot of things in the body to maybe try to push those reactions. And if you do have Celtic blood in you, you may have that, what they call the Celtic curse, where that enzyme just is not working too well in you, and you can try to push that through biochemistry. Now, you mentioned other antioxidants in the diet that... because we only mentioned supplements, but you mentioned cocoa powder. What are some really good dietary antioxidants that you get your clients on or talk about?
Well, you know, since you mentioned cocoa, let me rave about cocoa flavanols, which there's a lot of good research now on blood pressure and cocoa flavanols. They do really appear to lower blood pressure, and they certainly seem to protect the heart, possibly by stimulating the production of something called nitric oxide, which is an important molecule for the relaxation of the vessels. I am a big fan of cocoa flavanols. I even take them as a supplement. They're available at like GNC and Vitamin Shoppe of cocoa flavanols. Sometimes they even are mixed with something like coenzyme Q10, which is a terrific mixture, coenzyme Q10, and these blood pressure lowering, heart healthy cocoa flavanols. So yeah, dark chocolate is a great health food. Wild salmon with all of its omega-3s and that powerful astaxanthin, which is a huge antioxidant. That's the stuff that makes wild salmon pink. Grass-fed beef.
So do you like krill oil, Johnny? Do you like krill oil, which has a lot more of those things?
I do love krill oil. I think a lot of the arguments about should we get fish oil or krill oil or a triglyceride form of fish oil or the ester form of fish oil, I think is a lot of, you know, I hope my friends in the natural products industry will forgive me. I think it's a tempest in a teapot.
Okay.
Any of them are good. I don't know that the difference between krill and regular fish oil is that great. Maybe it's a little bit you can show on paper, but people need this stuff, and nobody's getting enough of it. So I think the debate about which one is a little bit better is kind of, let's put that one off. Let's just get this stuff in whatever form you like. You like krill oil, krill oil. You like regular fish oil. I don't think it makes that much difference.
But some people can't digest it too well, so... Is there a way that you get your patients? I know you have a degree in nutrition. I just tell people to take it with some lecithin, and maybe it'll help them. Because some people like belch up fish oil when they take it. I've noticed.
Well, there's a number of reasons for that, and very often, believe it or not, it's because it's rancid. You know, the fish oil is only as good as the fish it comes from. If you're getting your fish oil from, that's why I tell people really buy the good stuff. If you're getting it, you know, from the big box stores where it's, God knows, imported from where, and the fish come from the bottom of the Hudson River somewhere, some catfish. I mean, it's not, you know, it's as good as the fish it comes from. And a lot of times that regurgitation, yes, sometimes it's because we don't digest fat as well, but sometimes it's also because it's not good stuff. Putting it in the freezer tends to get rid of that. But you should make sure that you're getting stuff that is really high quality, small companies. Like, for example, Barlean's is a company that's available everywhere in stores. I know they test their stuff every which way for impurities and make it in small batches. There's a number of companies like that. So, you know, go for the good stuff. Don't go for the bottom shelf at the CVS and God knows where it came from and how long it's been sitting there. And that does go a long way towards making it a little bit more digestible.
Great. Johnny, tell us where we can get your information and website and where we could get the book before we close
in
a few minutes.
The book is on Amazon, and the book, I'm thrilled to say, is number one in heart disease. It's beating out Esselstyn's book on the no-fat diet, the Cleveland Clinic program for heart disease. We're actually beating him. So, you know, everybody, I hope you read this book, and I really believe this message is important. Of course, we want to sell a lot of books, but we want to change the conversation about how we treat heart disease in America. And the book is available on Amazon, on Barnes & Noble. It's in bookstores, and it's called The Great Cholesterol Myth.
Yeah, I had it out in my waiting room now for a few weeks because, you know, the publicist sent me it one, and
Thank you.
I tell you, it's been the most popular book out in my lobby here.
Thank you so much for saying that. Thank you. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
All righty. And that does it for another edition of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And again, we were discussing the great cholesterol myth and why lowering your cholesterol won't prevent heart disease and the statin-free plan that will. So we'd like, on behalf of Dr. Kamai and myself, we'd like to wish everyone a great new year and of health and happiness. And we will see you soon. Stay healthy. Bye.